it takes space to be able to ask difficult questions and learn and make mistakes. But the point is finding a way to make those mistakes in ways that don't harm your constituencies and your communities, but where you're improving over time, but not at the expense of the populations that you're meant to support.
Welcome back to the AI Element, a show about what AI can actually do. I'm your host, Alex Shi. This week, we're exploring the topic of AI governance. AI is a powerful tool, and with that power comes a great deal of responsibility. It has the power and capability of improving efficiency and helping us free up time and space. But in trying to become more efficient, there are many new risks and other potentially unforeseen circumstances that could lead to oversight and harm. How can we be sure that we're in control of AI systems? And what should the governance look like? Data governance is an existing practice that covers a lot of ground because of how integral data is to AI's functioning. However, AI's ability to learn and evolve over time means it will adapt to changes in its environment based on the objective given by its designers. That dynamic relationship between environment and model makes things like the design of the system and its objective just as integral as the data the model runs on. Managing the risks of these new dynamic systems has been widely branded as AI governance. In this episode, we're going to look at the growing need for AI governance in the financial sector, as well as get some advice on how to approach it from technologists working to protect human rights. But to kick it off, we've asked Richard Zuroff, a director of AI advisory and enablement here at Element AI, to explain a little bit more about what the term AI governance covers.
I think it's useful to maybe clarify three broad areas that can reasonably be called AI governance. One set of questions is around how governments should or shouldn't use AI, and you could call this public sector governance of AI. So here, there's been a lot of focus on areas like facial recognition technology by the police and where it should or shouldn't be used. There's another set of questions about how humanity as a whole or world governments should control the development of AI. And so there's been a lot of focus on things like how do we ensure that really smart AIs or AGI, which are purely hypothetical today, have values and motivations that are aligned with our own. You might call that global AI governance or something like that. And then the third area asks, how should private sector organizations choose to use AI? How can they do things like ensure they stay compliant with both industry level and cross-industry regulation, as well as meeting their commitments to the communities they serve and their corporate values? And it's this third type of AI governance that I'm focused on. You could think of it as sort of internal or private governance of AI. So for me, that type of AI governance is policies, procedures, and technologies that companies are putting in place to help make sure the AI applications they're building or deploying are reliable, safe, trustworthy, and accountable.
What's the difference between AI governance and data governance?
So the way I think about it, data governance is part of good AI governance, but they're not necessarily the same. So traditional data governance was focused on making sure that data were consistent and clean and a bunch of other really positive attributes that are critical for having good applications. But it generally takes the data creation process itself as a given. Whereas with AI governance, because you're using the data to directly create the models, you need to go further. So what I mean by that is, let's take traditional data governance. So you might want to, for example, make sure that all your employees have a single identifier that lets you connect information from different systems like recruiting or HR and payroll, so that when you're doing things like reporting, the information is accurate. And so good governance needs to make sure that you can do those joins and that it's clean and timely and all of those things. if you're not doing that, then whatever models you're feeding it into aren't going to be good models. So you need to do that work. But for something like AI, you also need to go deeper. So if you take the example of some of the recent criticisms of some companies that were using AI for doing CV analysis as part of their recruiting process, the criticisms were that the algorithms were biased against women. And the issue wasn't that the information in the databases was wrong. It was actually correct. But historically, many companies haven't done a good job at hiring women and creating enough diversity. So that meant that the data they had was skewed in favor of creating new successful applicants that looked like old successful applicants. And you're not going to get better gender diversity and all of the benefits that come with things like that just by doing data governance. You need to go further. And that idea of going further and taking on that higher degree of responsibility, for me, is part of what distinguishes AI governance from some of the more traditional approaches.
So those are some of the problems that can arise. But what does good AI governance look like?
I think good governance practices help ensure that product or journey owners are thinking deeply about stakeholders and how the AI applications being built could impact them. And if you're making AI applications more responsible, which could mean making them more reliable or more interpretable for people through things like explainability, well, I think that will also make them more appealing and more trustworthy for users. And ultimately, if you have applications that are more appealing and more trustworthy, I think you're going to get adoption that's faster and broader, which is at least on the pathway towards more value creation and not just about downside risk protection.
In creating the governance for more trustworthy and responsible AI, what are the kinds of considerations designers and engineers should make? Tanya O'Carroll and Alex Dunn have thought long and hard about these questions. They've been studying the externalities of AI and its impact on human rights for years, and have even taken on the challenge of creating their own technology applications to solve problems in these sensitive environments. Tanya is the director of Amnesty Tech at Amnesty International. Alex is the director of Computer Says Maybe, focusing on new methods that are necessary to equitably innovate. Before Alex started Computer Says Maybe, she ran a nonprofit called The Engine Room that focused on supporting civil society to take up their data and tech in a way that reinforces their values. While doing that work, she met Tanya and one of her colleagues. She still remembers something from that time about the potential risks of implementing new tech.
I mean, one of Tanya's current colleagues was a colleague who worked within the Responsible Data Program. And she made a point that has stuck with me for years, which is that there's a very thin line between innovation and experimentation on people. And that when we think about the sort of rosy tech deterministic perspective on how technology is going to make everything better, that for civil society, because of the populations they were working with and because their values were ostensibly quite clear, there was a higher calling for them to be much more intentional with the way that they were relating between their use of technology and the people that would be affected by that technology. But even if you have that intention, actually operationalizing it, yeah, as I'm sure you know, is really difficult. And it takes space to be able to ask difficult questions and learn and make mistakes. But the point is finding a way to make those mistakes in ways that don't harm your constituencies and your communities, but where you're improving over time, but not at the expense of the populations that you're meant to support.
Absolutely. And it starts as a human rights organization, it obviously starts with human rights for us. And when we entered into this field, which I think at the time that we entered into it around 2014, 2015, when I say this field, I'm specifically talking about artificial intelligence. And there was not that immediately it started to be these questions raised as to the black box problem, the existential debate for a long time as to whether it was worse to have, you know, a human discriminate against you versus a black box discriminate against you, an algorithm. The way we cut through those debates was to kind of remind people that there is actually already a very clear global ethical framework, which is called human rights. And in fact, there's years and years of thinking about what the responsibilities of companies are in how they anticipate, so kind of assess for and anticipate unintended consequences or potential human rights harms, how they can prevent and mitigate against those harms, and also how they can provide access to justice and remedy when things do go awry. And so a lot of the work that we've done in the last couple of years is just trying to get that framework out there, trying to adapt the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, the so-called RUGI framework, to AI and machine learning and technology more broadly.
So how can we be more mindful when we make these decisions with our technology? How can we stop the unintended consequences that negatively impact our communities? Alex had an interesting way to reframe that question.
I think in many ways, unintended consequences are, that phase of consideration is in many ways a luxury, because it implies that you've dealt with all of the other externalities that, one, you know about, and two, that you should know about, or else you're negligent. And I think it's important to say that those two phases are really important to consider before we get into unintended consequences. So I think there's many, 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 many examples of products being developed when it is negligent, the consequences that resulted. And so in retrospect, calling those unintended sometimes I think gives cover in a way that I think is problematic. But I'd also say unintended consequences as a frame can also be overly consequentialist, to get like philosophical, that if we focus on perfecting the outcomes, we're not actually focused on the should questions. So saying, for example, that we should measure whether or not something was good by whether or not it caused harm sort of biases us towards experimentation that leads to harm, which we then recognize and then ideally fix. If we think a little bit about the difference between consequentialist ethics and deontological ethics, so the difference being with consequentialist ethics, you say if the outcome is good, then the decision was good. And with deontology, you say it doesn't matter if the outcome was quote unquote good, if the decision that was taken shouldn't have been taken, which is a bit of sort of a mind pretzel, but it basically says it's ends versus means. So if you say that the end was fine, there go the means are acceptable, that doesn't work in a lot of situations. And within technology, I think we've overly focused on the ends, and it's kind of a cop out in some ways, because in many ways, by the time you get to the point of measuring the ends, the cat is out of the bag. The market share is captured, the harm is being caused to communities that can't actually do anything about it, and the equity is accumulated by the people that built the thing. And so then it feels too late, really, to do the type of work that needs doing. What we should be doing is saying, is it acceptable to do X at all? Not, can we make it work for our purposes? And yeah, I think the conversation around unintended consequences sometimes, it lets us delay too long considerations of whether or not something should have happened. And I think that can be really dangerous.
To understand further, we asked Alex for an example of consequentialist and deontological thinking in AI, and how these different ways of thinking can impact the average citizen.
Like facial recognition, for example. So when you have this debate and this conversation about facial recognition, the people that really want to push it through will say, look, we can get the accuracy to 100%, and then what's going to happen is you're going to see a reduction in terrorism or crime or even inconvenience at the airport. And by saying that that is the outcome, they ignore the underlying question of, do we want to live in a society where there is facial recognition being used everywhere we go? And the fact that we're uniquely identified while walking down the street and there's very little ability to hide from being recognized. And I think those are two fundamentally different questions, which make the conversation very difficult to have. So having a conversation with someone who wants to focus on the consequences of the technology, when you want to talk about the underlying rights issues for society, you can't really get anywhere. And I think it's an example, I think, where these types of conversations can break down. And I think industry isn't in good faith negotiating and navigating and sort of engaging with the debate of those underlying should questions, because it's not actually in their interest to do that. There's something called the Matthew effect from the Bible. And it's essentially that if you dump a ton of resources into an unregulated space, that the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. And I think that we see that within the value that technology creates, that if we don't regulate these spaces, we don't proceed with caution and care, you end up making powerful people more powerful and weak people even weaker and have even less access to power. And I think that calls for a fundamental rethinking of how we think about shareholder value, because shareholders in technology companies is everyone, because we're all affected by the tools as they sort of take over our world.
In response to this, Alex has been exploring a practice she calls agile ethics, which focuses on ethical assessment and adaptation when adopting new technology. Alex and Tanya told us more about this concept of agile ethics and how it can help improve AI governance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an attempt to build the people process necessary internally to iteratively reflect on the implications and potential implications of projects. Like, in my mind, it starts with clear values, and part of those clear values are red lines in terms of what you won't do. But it also involves designing internal systems so that you can increase consistency of decision making across product teams. I think there's a lack of coherence from the top of organizations all the way down to product teams. So rather than expecting a product team to be able to make a really high level decision about whether or not something's appropriate, there needs to be adjudication structure in your company so that you're able to essentially say, this is above my pay grade. And there's a process that I know that I can appeal to get support to make those choices. And it's more appropriate for more parts of the organization to be making these decisions with more context than me as a data scientist or AI engineer, developer, or pretty much anybody that's engaging with technology. And then once you have that adjudication structure, you have to be able to learn and evolve over time so that those values are not a paragraph or a sentence, but they're actually meaningfully feeding into the documentation on how decision-making happens in the organization. And at the end of the day, I think the goal is that you have auditable, traceable decision-making that's happening in the company so that if ultimately something goes wrong or a choice is made within the context of a product that actually doesn't align with the values of the organization, that there's accountability. I think what we see, and I mean, I personally have been very frustrated by, is that a lot of companies that have been encouraging to have the space for self-regulation don't actually set rules. And then when the rules are broken, they enforce those rules. They are wishy-washy and talk about principles and intent and things that are very personal and interpersonal, which makes it incredibly difficult to pin them down when they do things that are problematic. And I think from a governance perspective, to me, that's just hugely important for us to move past. So Agile Ethics is an attempt to sort of build some of that infrastructure.
To add to that, because I mean, I really like this concept of Agile Ethics, and I can see how it makes very granular, a very daily way, these micro decisions that everybody is responsible for making already. And it gives that structure and process. But I also think it's worth saying that, again, back to human rights, I mean, this isn't actually a question of choice, you know, i.e. companies can opt in or opt out of this. I mean, actually, companies very clearly under these international frameworks, including the RUGI principles that I mentioned, already have a responsibility to actually, like I said, assess, mitigate, and provide remedy. The whole process is something called human rights due diligence. It's very clear there's actually whole guidelines that are available for companies. There's consultancies and other companies that provide really dedicated advice in how do you set up an effective human rights due diligence process. Starts with doing something called human rights impact assessment, so that, again, at the inception point of any new project, you are anticipating all of those potential human rights harms that may come from the project or product that you're designing and developing. And then I think baking that due diligence process in with this kind of agile ethics, much more micro day-to-day decision-making process that Alex is talking about is really powerful, and I think could go a really long way, not only to actually helping companies do the right thing, but also to being accountable and making sure that we, like, that paper trail is there. She's saying that there is, when questions are asked, that there's actual answers that are able to be provided. And a huge amount of this does boil down to, I mean, certainly not all of it, but a huge amount does boil down to transparency and much clearer, transparent processes and structures that people can know about.
I think we shouldn't just rely on regulation to get them to act. I think there is potential for incentivizing better behavior and incentivizing sort of a culture that has higher expectations of them than just purely driving towards profit.
As Richard mentioned at the top of the episode, AI governance as a whole has both to do with the internal governance of a company as well as external regulations from government. And as Alex suggested, the internal governance will be closely tied to what the external regulations dictate. One heavily regulated industry that is seeing rapid adoption of AI is finance. Our next guest, Jesse McWaters, leads the exploration of financial technology and innovation for the World Economic Forum. Jesse and his team have written extensively on how AI is transforming the financial sector. He has found that although AI does not yet pose significant systemic risk, a new form of governance will be needed in the near future.
I guess what we ended up realizing was that in many ways, the very difficulties that make it challenging to predict the future of AI are the difficulties that make it hard to effectively govern AI processes in a financial context and regulate them. The reasoning of AIs is inherently inhuman. They evolve autonomously over time in an environment that's traditionally been most familiar with highly static models. And in some instances, particularly more advanced deep learning models, they're foundationally opaque. And so this means that the tools that we have traditionally used to ensure that the financial sector remains fair, accessible, safe, stable, are no longer necessarily fit for purpose when it comes to safeguarding the system. And it requires a certain kind of becoming comfortable with being uncomfortable. We're going to have to, in some cases, leave behind the tried and tested methodologies that we've used to keep the financial system and its users safe, and we're going to have to explore new mechanisms. But one thing I really want to underline here is that I take some personal umbrage with this narrative of a need to create a new AI ethics. We've asserted a new AI physics, but I will deny the existence of a new AI ethic.
Okay, so what Jesse's suggesting, denying the need for a system of new AI ethics, may catch you off guard. It caught us by surprise too. But let's hear him out.
I think that foundationally, at the highest level, the things that we expect the financial sector to deliver, fairness for users, transparency around decisions, a stable system. These things are all still the expectation for the financial sector. And indeed, I personally believe that AI capabilities give us the opportunity to raise the bar on what we consider the target for those criteria. But to do that, we're going to need to be willing to think about the world a little differently.
So Jesse's position is actually very similar to Tanya's about the existing responsibility of companies to assess, mitigate, and provide a remedy for human rights violations. As Richard mentioned earlier, one of the risks AI governance could help mitigate is bias. He suggested that part of the solution could be explainability. Opening up a given AI model and allowing its decision-making process to be accessible and interpretable by its users. Jesse went on to share the way he saw just how much explainability could be needed, or not, in different parts of financial decisions.
We talk about some of the potential systemic risks of the use of AI in financial services, but are clear that we just don't think that AI is yet being used at such a scale that these are significant risks, but that they may be in the future. I think where we see the greatest degree of development is around the instances where AI has penetrated most deeply into financial processes, and that's around adjudication decisions, and specifically around the use of systems that may become biased. And so you'll see entities like the Consumer Bureau of Financial Protection who have done a great deal of work thinking about how as loan adjudication becomes more complex, we should think about some of the challenges of bias that arise from that. A different way of thinking about explainability that fits into what I was talking about earlier in terms of we need to think about new models and new tools for ensuring that these systems meet the bar. Effectively, it says, why do you need this explanation? What is it that an explanation gives to you? So let's start at the top. Do you need any explanation at all, for example, to have a system that flags suspicious transactions for manual investigation? I think a lot of people would make the argument that systems for identifying money laundering, fraud, insider trading need not necessarily be interpretable. They need only work, particularly where humans become involved relatively early on in the process and where their primary function is one of triage. Sometimes what you're looking for is context for the consumer or for the business user. They need to understand why a decision got made. And for them, the code and code transparency aren't necessarily particularly useful there. The individual on the street is trying to understand why their loan got denied and what they need to do differently in the future. And then as we get into the more technical details, there are instances where you might, for example, need to determine whether or not bias has crept its way into the model. And there it might be sufficient to be able to interrogate specific aspects of the hidden layer. And you're seeing a lot of specialized technology firms looking to develop solutions that that offer that type of narrow interpretability of these deep learning models.
The rules of business vary across the globe, and Jesse has looked at a lot of AI's implementation in financial companies in Asia. We asked him if he thought different regional perspectives will impact the way regulators define guardrails for AI in the financial sector.
I think that they will, but I don't think that it's necessarily clear how. There's a frequent discussion in the West that will often characterize Chinese citizens as not being concerned about how their data is used. And many of the folks that I've spoken to in China take quite some umbrage to that notion. And one of the narratives that I hear frequently is that the mismatch is really in terms of how we think about who uses that data. That in China, while data and privacy requirements are, I think, undoubtedly weaker there than they are, at least today, than they are in a place like Europe, the focus is more on governing the way in which companies use data, with less focus on the ability of the state to use that data. By contrast, if you look at consumer disposition in the United States, there's until recently been very little introspection about the way in which these large technologies use data, but a culturally well-established sense in which many people are concerned about the data that the government has on them and how that's used. And so I think that concerns around privacy are likely to universally rise as customer data becomes more and more important to business models, and as consumers become more aware of how their data is being used. But the specific preferences for how privacy should be enforced may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
I'm just curious. I'm thinking about GDPR and how it's impacted businesses around the world. Do you think that the first kind of wave of regulation on the financial industry will come from one large jurisdiction or one specific policy that'll push everybody in a direction?
It's clear that GDPR has had a significant impact. It's forced globally operating institutions to start to treat it as a floor for a lot of their privacy standards, and has, in a sort of de facto sense, resulted in protection specifically iterated for Europeans being extended to many non-Europeans. And moreover, it's clear that the discussions about privacy regulation everywhere from China to California has been influenced by GDPR, and it's often a starting point for these discussions. But nonetheless, I think that the integration of humans into the oversight of these processes is absolutely essential. And I think that goes from the very granular to the very large.
Jesse's suggestion that AI governance needs humans in the process brings us back to a question for Richard. Just where does AI governance fit in an organization's operations?
Well, I think something like AI ethics should probably be everywhere in a company from top to bottom. But we see AI governance emerging in at least two places. So there is a need for some sort of centralized expertise, so a COE for AI governance. In financial services companies, there's usually a group called the Model Risk Management Group that is responsible for validating models before they're put into production. Now, they're separate from model developers who might be in individual business units, and these model risk managers perform more or less intensive review of documentation and testing depending on how important the consequences of the model are. Now, these types of groups are required in many financial institutions by regulation, but you can imagine having a similar group with a similar mandate in really any organization that's putting multiple AI models into production. You should probably have some sort of a piece of the organization that's separate and is doing a certain amount of testing, so kind of playing the referee role. But I think it's also important that governance not be just isolated in a single center or a risk function. You want to have it living in individual teams. So you can have product managers, service managers who are sitting close to data scientists and the model builders and helping to make sure that there's that empathy for end users and that the data is in good shape. So I think that here AI governance is about the types of everyday practices these teams are doing and not necessarily a one-time validation that a centralized group. So I think you need both.
Hmm. And then how are organizations taking it on from what you've seen? Do you have any tangible examples of how AI governance has matured in an organization?
So for me, I'd say a mature AI governance capability is one that is actually accelerating innovation, to your point about it not just being about risk, but about value creation. I think there's a tendency to associate governance with risk and compliance, which some people see as the types of activities that slow things down. But AI risks are real, right? And stewards of the organization, like senior management and boards, aren't going to let this type of technology proliferate unless they feel the organization can manage those associated risks. So companies that invest early in AI governance may be a tiny bit slower at going from one model to 10 models because they're doing this work. But I think at least that they're going to be dramatically faster at going from 10 models to 100 models or 1,000 models in production. And when the organization recognizes governance as that strategic accelerator is when I'd say it's really matured.
The pressure to move fast with tech is big, but both human rights and new business rules give powerful reasons to implement strong AI governance. So if you want to move fast on AI governance. Like Alex and Tanya said, poor AI governance is already impacting people around the globe.
This is not just a kind of interesting intellectual discussion. This is not just an interesting, let's bat this stuff around, that this is urgent. This is very serious, and this is already leading to all kinds of very real consequences for people in their lives, and therefore we're already behind. Like, we need to have sorted this out yesterday, and there's actually a lot you can already be doing.
For more information on everything you heard in this episode, including Alex Dunn's Agile Ethics, Jesse McWater's New Physics of Finance, Tanya O'Carroll's ideas for AI applications for human rights monitoring, Richard Giroff's thinking on managing AI risks, and more on AI governance, visit the links in our show notes or go to elementai.com/podcast. Have a question we didn't cover? Tweet at us at @element_AI and use the hashtag #TheAIElement, and we'll cover it in an upcoming episode. Thanks again to our guests. The AI Element is produced by Simon Hudson, Amanda DuRepo, and Edit Audio's Steph Colburn and Ali Silva. The music is by Bynard and Lee Rosever. Our booker is Claudia Rodari. Visual design by Weiwei Lin. Shout out to our digital and promotions team, Kyla, Vince, Benoit, Jen, Robin, and Kevin. Vanessa Dreyfus shot our behind-the-scenes look. Finally, thank you to Anne, Christophe, and Viera for making this happen.